Welcome, everyone. We'll open our session of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. Just note for the record, we're going to move Senate Bill 447 to the bottom of the agenda at Senator Brzezinski's request. He's the sponsor of that bill. So we'll start with a work, not excuse me, we'll start with the public hearing on Senate Bill 639. And Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 639 defines a digital billboard as an advertising sign that is static and changes messages no more than every 8 seconds through a process that is accomplished in no more than 2 seconds, exempts digital billboards that do not create the appearance of movement, operate at a low light intensity, automatically adjust intensity of light, and freeze the display in case of malfunction of signs, which are not permitted to be erected or maintained. Declares an emergency, there's no revenue impact, and there's minimal expenditure impact.
Thank you. And Mr. Parsons?
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Brad Parsons. I'm the branch president for Clear Channel Outdoor, and as a member of the Oregon Outdoor Advertising Association, also representing them today as well. Wanted to just talk about the technology on there. As we said, the introduction of Bill 639 would allow static copy changes. This technology would allow 8-second changes, no motion. They change within 2 seconds, and they would go to static copy. There's no movement of the billboards for changes. And being respectful for our time today, I've put together some binders that I believe you all have, and I just want to spend a few moments walking through those, if I may. And please stop me at any time to ask questions. And tab number one, we have letters from FEMA about the situation for billboards that have been out there for the bridge in Minneapolis. Maybe some of you remember that collapsing. We were able to utilize the digital technology within 15 minutes of the bridge going down. Also, the Department of Transportation, there is a buzz campaign that we use in other the cities to recognize and move through and help the states with that situation. Tab number two is going through the Homeland Security and what we did there for the use of the billboards for have been effective in implementing and helping with the FBI and the citizens in disaster also from timely message. Number two, the first letter there is some information from Robert Hoover, the Associate Director of Missing Children Division. We worked with the City of Portland with the Kyron Horman. We were able to get up 30 billboards for the missing child. We did three languages, Spanish, English, and Russian in that. And in that particular situation, we had to use our static billboards. It took us 8 days to get that message out. And with these digital opportunities, we could do that in about 15 to 20 minutes. It's my understanding that the first 24 hours are the most important with missing children. The next letter is from the Oregon Military Department, Michael Caldwell, looking at Amber Alerts, looking at utilizing this technology for the state for Amber Alerts. Some frequently asked questions. Tab 3, two senior members of Congress, floor statements that were made in April of 2009 and April of 2010, utilizing the technology, helping with the FBI as a wanted type poster situation. And tab 4, again, FBI recognition of what has been done across the country with Clear Channel and our agreement with them, playing roles in capturing many of the criminals that they are looking for out there. We also have a national partnership with FBI. And there's an example there of an FBI digital board that had been utilized across the country. And tab number five, just letters from local public service folks in Portland where we are main offices there. Just Susan Coleman, March of Dimes, you can go through there and see the utilization of what digital would do for them. Digital for these folks allows them to not have to pay production charges as we go forward and looking at that. Number six, tab six is for the FHA, and there is a safety neutral opportunity with digital billboards, and that has been backed up with a couple of the memos here that are included in that. Also, memorandum there again from the Federal Highway and then traffic data with that information. So just a few letters that that would help for the understanding of what this would bring to the state.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. I assume that besides all those PSAs, occasionally the owners do charge for advertising.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, do.
I sort of didn't cover that. Questions of Mr. Parsons? Seeing none? Guess not. Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you very much for your time.
Ms. Joyce.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, and formerly the head of the Outdoor Advertising Sign Program for the department. Handing out some written testimony with quite a bit of background on why ODOT and administers a program for the state that regulates billboards and other signs along state highways on private property. And I can go into any of that if you'd like, but getting to the meat of the bill, in Mr. Parsons' testimony, handed to you the 2007 Federal Highway Administration Memorandum regarding the use of digital billboards, changing message signs, same thing, different terms. And that memo made clear that states could have these along state-controlled routes as long as they provided for certain sideboards or constraints on that, things like rate of change and hold times on those. And those items do show up in this bill, so it appears to the department that, as written, the bill does cover those things Federal Highway requires. The other item Federal Highway requires, if a state is going to go to this technology and allow it, is that there should be evidence that the state provided for appropriate public input. So ensuring compliance with Federal Highway, including that 2007 memo, is critical for the state to keep federal highway funding, which failure to regulate billboards and other signs appropriately can lead to the loss of federal funding. But clearly there's a pathway for the state to do that.
What is the requirement on public input? Is it on any time someone wants to erect a sign or...
Chair Beyer, the memo appears to say that when the state is making the decision as to whether to allow this new technology, there should be allowance for public input into that decision, not when each and every application were to come into the department. There's not a public comment period on any application for a sign of that nature.
So would the legislative hearings qualify?
Chair Beyer, I don't know that I could opine on what Federal Highway thinks, but certainly this is a public process with notice given, and so I can't necessarily say that,
I would assume if the legislature were to enact this bill that ODOT would then have to have some type of rulemaking process around it?
Chair Beyer, yes, the terms of the bill do require that we perform at least one rulemaking regarding the brightness of the sign and how we would measure that. There are probably a couple of other rules we would need to amend in terms of how we process applications and do surveillance on this kind of a sign, but it would be pretty minor.
Okay.
But certainly that provides for a public process as well.
Okay.
So to implement the provisions of the bill, the next point in my testimony, the department would need to make some minor changes to what we do. So, again, to conclude, Oregon's laws are largely based on federal requirements, and that 2007 memo that you have before you outlines what you need to consider in making this policy decision.
So it looks like the department has taken no position on the bill.
Chair Beyer, you are correct.
Okay.
The question is, we had previous testimony of all the good things that it could do. What access does ODOT, or say there's an Amber Alert, what access do they have to the private sign? If they chose not to put it up, do we have any legal right to ask for a certain amount of time during certain emergencies to this technology?
Chair Beyer, Representative Girard, I'm not aware of any legal requirement. There's nothing like that in the bill, and the Oregon Constitution is quite clear that we can have no input whatsoever mandating any kind of content on a side. I'm quite certain in my dealings with the folks in the billboard industry, and they have mentioned before that they are amenable to those kinds of alerts, just as they've shown in the booklet testimony they provided to you.
Other questions? I just have one. Are we talking about the kind of sign that if we just go north out of Salem that's on the Shemawa property?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we're talking about?
Chair Beyer, you're correct. On I-5 at the Chamao property, yes, that is that kind of sign. If you're wondering why that sign is there,
property.
It's because it's a tribal trust property where our state regulations have absolutely no effect.
Okay. No other questions? Thank you very
Thank
much.
You, Chair.
Is there anybody else who wishes to act on this or testify on this bill? Seeing none, I think we'll move to work session. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 639, and we will open the work session on Senate Bill 639.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
I move Senate Bill 639 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starrs moves Senate Bill 639 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Senator.
Thank you. I just want to publicly thank Clear Channel for their work in helping the public, using this their space to do ads that are beneficiary. And specifically, there's a series of ads that are going up for Compassion First, which is a nonprofit that deals with human sex trafficking. And as a point of being very, very careful about conflict of interest, I will note a possible conflict in that I am on the Compassion First Board of Directors, and Clear Channel, who is the requester of this bill, has provided a number of billboards for Compassion First. So I want to make that as a point of potential conflict. I don't think it's a real conflict because it doesn't impact me financially, but in the case of being very, very clear, having said all of that, Clear Channel is a great corporate citizen and provides, I think, a significant amount of corporate benefit, community benefit in our state. So.
Thank you, Senator. Is there any further discussion on the motion? The motion on the table is to pass Senate Bill 639 to the floor with the due pass. Is there any opposition? See no opposition. Senate Bill 639 is passed the floor with the due pass unanimously. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill
Carrier.
I think Senator Starr wants to carry this bill.
Certainly. Be happy to.
And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 759.
Senate Bill 759 defines gross mutual wagering for the purposes of laws regulating racehorsing and greyhound racing. I do not yet have a revenue impact on this, but I do have no fiscal expenditure noted by fiscal.
Okay. The first person I have signed up is Athena Douglas. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Athena Douglas. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association in support of Senate Bill 759. We actually requested this bill be written. I brought my executive director.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dick Cartney. I'm the executive director of the Oregon HBPA.
Going back a little bit, Oregon started regulating horse racing in 1933, and at that time, the phrase pari-mutuel wagering was used for everything. But it really only meant when you walked into a race with live animals on the day of the race and you placed a bet on that race. Today, there are multiple ways to place bets. You can do it through telephone, through computer, at a live race meet, at an off-track betting parlor, and at the live race meets, that bet may be placed with a live clerk or through a machine. And so now, gross mutual wagering has many, many different ways it is used in the statute. So we are looking to clarify each use of that within the statute. It has come to our attention. We've been working with the Oregon Racing Commission on this a little bit, and our language is not quite perfect yet within this bill, so we're going to continue to work on that, but we thought we would get our hearing out of the way. Do you have any questions?
So, to be clear, you're working on an amendment.
Correct.
So it's not ready to move. Okay. Questions? Senator Burke.
What's the problem that's being addressed here? Is some problem come up?
Chair Beyer, Senator Burke, there's not an actual problem yet. But the fact that we have to work on this further because it is used, the phrase gross mutual wagering is used so many times in so many different ways, kind of says that there are problems waiting to happen. The statutes are so old in some parts that we need to update them, house cleaning, just to clarify things. So there is not an issue yet.
Okay, because I'm trying to follow, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I'm trying to imagine the type of problem that might develop from this. If people are doing all these things under the current language, and believe me, I do not oppose updating the statutes. I think that's a great thing to do, but just so I can understand it, what's the peril of...
Chair Beyer, Senator Burdett, my understanding is that there are places where the statute talks about what taxes the horse racing industry may or may not pay, and some of that has to do with what type of bet it is, yet it all refers to gross mutual wagering, and the tax rates are different for which type of bets they are, and again, when this was written, there was only one way to bet, so there was only one tax rate. There's more potential problems, I believe, than just that, but that's something we're trying to avoid, is something in that line.
The size of the betting pool.
More?
No, I'm good.
Anything else? Thank you very much. Rob Douglas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rob Douglas, here today representing the Oregon Thoroughbred Breeder and Owners Association. Joan Buck and I have had the pleasure of representing these fine folks since 1978. The previous testimony is accurate. The racing statutes go back to 1933. Not all of those statutes have been updated. We have things like advanced wagering, we have wagering by telephone, all these different types of wagering were not anticipated in those days. Trying to tighten up these definitions, we are very supportive of that.
Questions, Mr. Douglas? Senator Durant.
Thank you. What changes are we looking for in the bill? I was kind of reading through it, and all we're doing is doing one little definition. So obviously there's something that needs to be changed. Are you aware of what that is?
From the present existing language that's in the bill?
Yeah.
No, I do not know what that is, but I've heard that upon review that the language may not be tight enough and may need some additional work, which would occasion an amendment.
Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Douglas. Does the Racing Commission have anything to say on this one?
let this one pass. Seems like it's right up your alley.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Randy Evers. I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Racing Commission. We are fully aware of the concept behind Senate Bill 759. We agree wholeheartedly with it. We just gave the language to our Assistant Attorney General, and she would like a little bit of time to look at it, make sure it accomplishes the goal in the concept. With your permission, Chair Beyer, I might try to answer Senator Burdick's question just in a little bit more detail. The statute's very old. When it was written, the only way to place wagers in horse racing was to drive to Portland Meadows and place your wager, or when we used to have the state fair, at the state fair. So gross mutual wagering basically included Oregonians betting on racing in Oregon. Today, there are many different opportunities to wager. For instance, you can be at Portland Meadows betting through what we call simulcasting on a race in California at Santa Anita. Under this concept, that would be a bet placed in Oregon, and the tax would be collected on that wager. Conversely, Portland Meadows sends their signal all across the country. So you could have a person in New York wagering through an off-track betting site in New York on an Oregon race, and that would not be considered an Oregon wager. That's a New York wager that goes through the New York betting system. Just because it's on an Oregon race would not give Oregon jurisdiction to tax that. I spent 28 years at the Oregon Department of Revenue. We don't want to get into double taxation type issues. So this language updates the statute to reflect our current practice. There's no revenue impact. There's no fiscal impact. It just clarifies this is our practice today, and the commission supports that.
Senator Burke?
So then I get my financing revenue hat on. watch out. So how are the taxes being collected now? Are they doing it as if this bill were already, are they doing it that taxing the Oregon wagers and not taxing the out-of-state wagers?
Yes, Chair Beyer, Senator Burdick, that's exactly correct. So a wager made at Portland Meadows, we collect the commission tax, and there are other fees that are taken. There's a small fee that goes to support the Backstretch Improvement Fund. There's a small fee that supports the breeding industry in the state of Oregon, and other fees that are collected. So a bet made at Portland Meadows, a wager made at any of our five summer race meets throughout the state, a wager made at an off-track betting site in Oregon, the commission tax and those fees are collected. We do not collect the fee on an out-of-state wager.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you. You can stay there. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Just to check. Seeing nobody there, we will, since we're waiting for an amendment, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 759, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 148.
Richard.
Senate Bill 148 forbids businesses from providing totalizator services through the use of a totalizator equipment in Oregon without a totalizator license issued by the Oregon Racing Commission. Authorizes the Oregon Racing Commission to establish administrative rule regarding the issuance and renewal of such totalizator licenses, including establishment of fees. Makes violation of this requirement a misdemeanor. There is no revenue impact, but there is a fiscal statement issued, but there's no request for a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by fiscal.
I bet you've been practicing that word for a week.
I think I got it right. You can ask them.
Totalizator.
Mr. Evers.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, again for the record, Randy Evers, Executive Director with the Oregon Racing Commission. And I do have a co-presenter, and I'm going to allow her to introduce herself.
I'm Audrey Kaufman, and I'm manager of mutuals and advanced deposit wagering hubs for the Oregon Racing Commission.
We are here today to ask your support for Senate Bill 148 with regard to grammar. I have heard it pronounced totalizator, and I've also heard it pronounced totalizator. So I think either is correct. We are here to ask for your support. This was a legislative concept that came from the Oregon Racing Commission, approved by our five commissioners, was submitted to the governor's office, and now is before you as Senate Bill 148. And again, we are here to ask for your approval. We do have an outline that we just handed out to you, and I'm going to ask Ms. Kaufman that she would give you a little background about Total iZator Companies and why we're here to ask for your support.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Beyer and committee members. I'm honored to be here to introduce some of the background information on this Senate bill. To identify originally the reason that we are actually have put together the language for introducing a Senate bill was that there was an identification that there was no oversight requirement of the totalizator companies or totalizator companies that are operating. So if you follow along on the outline that's in front of you, I put together just a little bit of bullet points about some of just the key functions that a tote, for abbreviation purposes, that's what they're actually generally referred to as tote companies,
totes,
the functions that they provide. So basically in our great state, in our 2009-2010 fiscal year, we processed approximately $1.4 billion in handle through tote companies in the state of Oregon. So what those companies are doing are tracking the total dollars that are being wagered by the public, and then they're creating basically buckets for each type of wager that might be offered either through an advanced deposit wagering company in OTB or at Portland Meadows. Then out of that, based on the particular host track that you would be wagering on, they will take out the takeout that is set by those states. And so that is communicated to these tote companies, and so they set that side, that money aside. And then from the remaining balance, they will calculate, based on the betting interest, the payout to the public. During the whole time, they'll be displaying information, whether it's on a tote board or on a video feed, showing the approximate odds for different types of wagers that someone might make. So in asking for licensing, we ask for having the regulatory oversight authority to make sure that they are following, maintaining high levels of security on that data, who's having access to the data, and so on. So we do have stakeholder support, and it is integral to both live and simulcasting wagering, as well as our advanced deposit wagering hub model. The license fee, we were looking at between $100 and $1,000 per year. We have some very, very small tote companies that service our fair meets, and then we have some large companies that might service our advanced deposit wagering companies. Most states that I'm aware of already require licensing of a tote operator. And I ask for your support, and I thank you for the opportunity. I would ask any questions that you might have at this time.
Thank you. Questions? Got off easy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Douglas.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Thoroughbred Breeder and Owners Association. We are in support of this bill. We think it's needed. Even though it is a fee bill, we are supportive. The subsequent bill you're not hearing now, but we'll hear in a little bit, is another fee bill, and we'll be supportive of that one as well. I think the Racing Commission has done a good job reaching out to the people that work with the Racing Commission with enough lead time to discuss these proposals before they brought them before you today. And we are very comfortable, even though we do not always see eye to eye with the regulator. In this case, we do.
Questions to Mr. Douglas?
Mr.
Senator Starr.
You don't have to answer this question. I love it when questions are asked like that. At some point in the future, will it ever make sense to put all the gambling in Oregon under one regulator? rather than have it spread across more than one?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, that has actually been discussed on previous occasions, and of course it's something, well, you know, what are the details of that? Depending on the details, I think that is a good topic for future conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything else? Senator Gerard?
Can we ask questions on 149, or do you want to?
I'm sorry?
Well, he addressed the fee bill, and I was kind of curious about that.
We're not on 149 yet.
Bring you back up here. Hold my horses. Hold my horses. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Douglas.
Thank you.
Mrs. Douglas.
Oh, that's quick.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Athena Douglas, again with the Oregon Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association. And since I was already in the room, I just wanted to make sure we conveyed our support of this bill, Senate Bill 148.
Thank you. Any questions for Mrs. Douglas? Everybody loves the bill. Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? That's all I have signed up. Seeing none, we will. And we have fiscals and all that on this, I guess.
Please. I'm sorry.
So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 148 and open the work session on Senate Bill 148.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 148 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Edwards has moved Senate Bill 148 to the floor with a due pass. Discussion. Seeing none, is there anybody in opposition?
Why do you always look at me?
Well, I'm just checking. Apparently there's no opposition. Senate Bill 148 is passed to the floor with the due pass recommendation unanimously. We'll close the work session. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 149.
Public hearing.
Excuse me. Public hearing on 149. Ms. You're up again, Randy.
And did we get the carrier?
You,
Did we get the carrier?
Senator Edwards wanted to carry that one.
I'm looking forward to saying totalizator or totalizator. Or
apparently you can call it anything you want.
All right. Just plain old toad.
Senate Bill 149 allows the Oregon Racing Commission to establish the license fees for officials, track operators, and other race meet participants and removes the current fees established in statute. There's no revenue impact. There is a fiscal impact statement issued, but there's no request to refer this to Ways and Means.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, again for the record, Randy Evers, Executive Director of the Oregon Racing Commission, and I do have a co-presenter, and I'd allow him to introduce himself.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Mike Twiggs, and I am the Deputy State Steward for the Oregon Racing Commission.
Chair Beyer, members, again, we ask for your support of Senate Bill 149. Again, this was a legislative concept that is supported by all five commissioners of the Oregon Racing Commission, was submitted to the governor's office, and now is before you as Senate Bill 149. I would like Mr. Twiggs to give you a little bit of background about licensing, who we are licensing, and a little bit about the process, and then we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, horse racing is a highly regulated sport. Anyone participating in that sport is required to be licensed. That's one of the tools we use to regulate the sport. Right now we have about 3,200 licensees holding about 3,700 licenses. That is due to some people doing more than one occupation within that racing community. The statute requires that the fee be set at $10 per year, with $2 a year for each add-on license. That's typically much lower than in neighboring states. For example, some of these licenses, let's just say, for example, an owner, trainer, racing official, or jockey might be licensed for $10 a year here in Oregon. For that same license in Washington, it would be $25, and in California, $50. It's been 31 years since the last revision of this statute, so the fees are obviously outdated. Mr. Evers was strongly encouraged by the legislative fiscal analyst during the 2009-11 session to put forward this legislative concept to increase the licensing fees. As a result of that, we had a stakeholder meeting at the Portland State Office Building, and in attendance for all the stakeholders that we could garner. They included Portland Meadows, the summer race meets offering horse racing throughout Oregon, which includes Union, Grants Pass, Prineville, Tillamook, and Burns. The Oregon Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders Association, the Oregon Horsemen's Benevolent and Protection Association, Oregon Quarter Horse Racing Association, and the Oregon Advanced Deposit Wagering Hubs. It was at this meeting that the stakeholders suggested that rather than increase the fee, that we change this statute to allow for determining those fees by rule. I have to note that we are honored that they have that level of confidence in us and in our administrative rule-changing process. The process would include working with stakeholders in determining the fees with consideration given to our purse structure as compared to other jurisdictions, as well as referencing the fees assessed by those other jurisdictions. And that's all I have, and I'm open to any questions.
So the basic question is, what happens if the fees aren't raised? If you're not given this authority, I guess that's more appropriate.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, if the statute is not changed, then the fees would remain at $10 per year.
And the effect of that? What are we buying?
I think we're trying to do two things. It's been 31 years since we raised the fees. I'm not sure that in and of itself is a reason to raise them, but we were certainly encouraged by in our budget process to raise the fees to something more reasonable with the Western states. When we discussed this with our stakeholders, and we had a very good stakeholder meeting, several of those members are in the room today, I think they acknowledged that the fees should go up. It's a professional license for them to do their job in the racing industry. We're very candidly looking at something like $20 a year, which I think is reasonable after 31 years. They're very supportive of that. We were going to change the statute. They actually suggested that, what isn't the commission asked for, the authority delegated by the legislature to allow the commission to do it by rule. So I think it's the statute's outdated, and I think it's time to look at it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Edwards and Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you just touched on my question, but I want to clarify, are we changing in this bill, are we changing the fee to a prescribed amount, or are we delegating authority to the commission to change the fee one time or on an ongoing basis as needed?
Chair Beyer, Senator Edwards, what the bill contemplates is that you are delegating authority to the Oregon Racing Commission to set the fee by rule. And that rule could be reviewed from time to time as other states adjust their fees. We would do that well. I will assure you that we will not do that without full support and cooperation from our stakeholders. And we would have a public hearing, obviously, with our administrative rule to make sure that, you know, we have support from that group. But the bill does contemplate giving us that authority.
Thank you for the clarification. Senator Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to follow up on the Chair's question. Is the money that you gain from this fee going to be used for a bigger Christmas party or something else?
Senator Beyer and Senator Burdick, thank you for the question. It would generate about $50,000 a year. The fees do come directly to the Oregon Racing Commission's budget. We don't anticipate a party. We do have additional fees. We're all going through a difficult budget time. I actually presented our budget to the Ways and Means Subcommittee. We're looking at some fairly significant cuts at the Racing Commission. This would allow us to bring back a portion of the Racing Commission's staffing. But I don't think it was necessarily generated as a revenue-raising measure for the commission and for budget purposes. It was very candidly raised as it's outdated and needs to be reviewed and should brought more in line with what other Western states are doing with regard to license fees. But it would generate about $50,000 a year for the Racing Commission budget.
Is the commission 100% other funds?
Chair Beyer, the Racing Commission is 100% other funds.
So it's supported by the industry through fees?
Chair Beyer, it's supported primarily by fees through our advanced deposit wagering companies and then through these license fees, as well as 1% of the tax on the betting handle that we discussed earlier today also comes directly to the Racing Commission for our budget.
You mentioned that you have you're looking at a cut in the Ways and Means process. Is that a revenue's not keeping up with your cost?
Chair Beyer, that is correct. Our revenues are not keeping up with our costs. We actually presented a budget proposal that, in light of that, we felt like we could manage our resources appropriately. In addition, there's a 5.5% cut that's in the governor's balance budget that we presented some options as well.
Senator Gerard?
Thank you, Chair Beyer. I love horse racing, but I don't think there's probably anybody in the community. I started when I was 6 years old and picked a ticket up on the floor and said, why did you pay $2 for a ticket? My dad looked at the ticket and it was a winner. And ever since then, I really like horse racing. Probably the only way I could ever win. But the problem I have, and I sit on Ways and Means, the fee increase, I called Dave Nelson, who obviously has quarter horse interest, and I understand the need for a fee increase, but to give you indefinite fee-raising ability to do that by rule, that gives me a lot of angst. Now, I just told the Dental Association that, you know, that they're out of line with some of their stuff, and so is there any way that we could compromise some of that? Because I understand you need to raise your fees. I would agree with raising fees now or give you some rules, but I think there has to be some oversight down the road. I mean, the interested parties might agree now, but 20 years down the road, there might be something that they don't, and then by rule, you could do pretty much what you wanted.
Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, I understand your concern. The original concept when we met with the stakeholders was to adjust the fee in the statute. It was our stakeholders that suggested that why don't you ask the legislature to delegate that authority to the commission. I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying. We may have that type of relationship today where it works well. It may not into the future. A compromise I would suggest would be to adjust the fee in the statute, and we could work with the chair or the committee administrator if that's a direction that the committee wanted to take.
More? Thank you very much. Next, Mr. Douglas.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Thoroughbred Breeders Association. We are in support of this bill. It was discussed with our leadership, with our members. There has been no resistance inside our membership to this bill. And I just point out for the chair and the committee, our members do pay some of these fees, but we are supportive of the legislation.
Questions of Mr. Tucker?
Senator Burton? Do you have any preference for putting the fee in the statute or allowing the open-ended approach?
Chair Beyer, Senator Burdick, it cuts both ways. We inadvertently, I've represented the CPAs for over 30 years, put their fee in statute last session, and now circumstances are such where the Board of Accountancy actually wants to reduce some fees, but has to come through and actually have legislation to do that, where previously that was delegated to the agency and they could do it by rule. If you trust the agency, it seems you ought to be able to delegate the fee setting to the agency. We've not had any bad experiences on the fee side with the Oregon Racing Commission.
Other questions?
I suppose, Mr. Chair, to just make a comment, with this meeting annually, if the Racing Commission got the quest for world domination going through the fee schedule, I suppose there would be ways to deal with that.
The legislature can always come back and change the statute.
But that's correct, and I think Mr. Douglas's point was well taken about how it does cut both ways on this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Douglas. You. Ms. Douglas.
They still have Ways and Means budget, right?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Athena Douglas with the Oregon Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association. We are also in support of Senate Bill 149. And we do, as a group, pay many, many of these fees, but they feel that they can work it out with the rules process.
So your preference is for the rules versus changing it in statute?
I believe that currently our preference would be for the rule process as opposed to the statute.
Questions?
I have a question.
Senator Edwards.
Well, and it's not necessarily for our current panelists, but perhaps somebody, maybe from the commission, could come and tell us a little bit more about their budget process. Do you have just a regular budget that we see through the Ways and Means process? And I'm presuming that you'd still be back presenting your budget and seeking spending limitation.
Well, let's Mr. Randy come up, but hold on to that. Does anybody have a question for Ms. Douglas? Thank you very much, Randy.
You.
Senator Edwards, I'm going to try to answer your question. We contemplated the $50,000 increase in our budget presentation of Ways and Means, so it is included as part of our limitation. If we did not get the revenue, then obviously our limitation would be slightly higher than our revenues, and we wouldn't be able to spend up to that limitation.
Mm-hmm. So in future years, if you were to raise fees beyond beyond a level that legislators were comfortable with in the Ways and Means process, then there would be a Ways and Means still check in being able to say we are not granting you spending limitation to spend up to, even though you have lots of revenue. We're not granting the authority. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
Chair Byers, Senator Edwards, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. That is all that I have signed up to testify. Does anybody else wish to testify on this? Here we go. For the record, you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, for the record, Roger Nyquist, and I've been involved in horse racing for 27 years now. I refer to it as my favorite mistake. It's the last last vestige from my reckless youth. I've owned horses. I've had an off-track site for years. I currently do some work with one of the ADWs, which is TVG. I was at the stakeholders meeting in which the suggestion was made to delegate authority to the agency. And while we all have concerns about fees going up to balance agency budgets because of the tight financial times, in this case, that concern is a little bit putting the cart before the horse, because the way the Racing Commission is funded and the way the industry works is tax on handle makes up the majority of the agency's budget, and you'll never get to a place with this agency where it will be fee supported for the horsemen or the people running around the track. And it's important to at least charge enough to help ensure the integrity of the sport for those licenses. If you don't, if racing gets to the point where their budget is not supported with handle tax, there won't be a sport left, and there won't be horsemen to have to charge a license fee to. So that's, in this case, I would represent that the stakeholders do, in fact, support delegated authority on the license fees.
Questions?
A comment.
Senator Rupp?
Yes, Roger, you made the statement that the biggest mistake you made was getting involved in horse racing. I would say, for people that don't know, is that it's going into the political arena, Rogers, Lynn County Commissioner. So
I said my favorite mistake.
Oh, yeah. All right. Blame me, Roger. Okay.
Thank you.
I just comment.
Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wants to take a shot at this? Okay. We will discussion on this.
I'll discuss. I would be happy to support, if the industry supports it, a increase in the fee in the statute. I know where I am philosophically on this. I've done this in the past with other agencies, and I regret it. If the fee needs to be raised, come make your case to the legislature. Let's raise the fee, and you know, we can have that conversation in the legislature. As this bill currently is, I really have heartburn supporting it. I you know, with all due respect to the stakeholders that support it, that's just not where I am philosophically, and I'd be inconsistent about how I aim to move forward in this particular legislative session if I were to make an exception in this case.
Okay, period. Anybody else have a...
I have a great deal of angst, but I have called Dave Nelson and Roger Nyquist was here, and I truly do love horse racing, and it's fallen on kind of tough times, and I want to make sure it survives. I thought I had it so it would survive at the state fair, and that kind of went sideways on me. So for the industry and the fact that Roger can keep losing money on it, it's kind of entertaining. So I think I'll probably support it.
Anybody else want to express an opinion? Roberti, do you want to move into work session on this?
Are we in work session? Are we in work session?
We're not yet.
Oh, okay.
Do you want to be in work? We will close the public hearing on...
I lost my...
Senate Bill 149. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 149. Senator Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 149 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Edwards moves Senate Bill 149 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? There is none. I think we'll call the roll on this one.
First time.
Senator Burdick?
Yes.
Senator Edwards?
Aye.
Senator Girard?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
No.
Senator Atkinson?
Aye. Atkinson. Senator Atkinson is excused. Sorry.
Aye.
Senate Bill 149 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Senator Girard.
Oh, no.
No? You know
what? Oh, yeah. Mr. Chair, may I respectfully suggest that you may want similar votes from him later in the session.
I gave you the vote.
All righty.
Although I know you don't like him.
No,
Senator Burdick, would you carry this bill, please?
I'd be happy to.
Senator Burdick is here. And, I did close on that, so now. All righty. We're going to stand at ease for a couple of minutes while we wait for Senator Pozanski on Senate Bill 447.
Do you anticipate moving 447?
Huh?
Do you anticipate moving that?
Do you want to stop?
I don't care whether one way or the other.
We have a member.
We can't.
We can't.
Then I have to go.
Okay.
Yeah,
I knew
you did.
No. Yeah,
we don't.
Would you call Senator Pozanski's office, please?
Will you call Senator Pozanski's office?
Where's Jason today?
He didn't.
Mm-hmm. Where's Jason today?
He had to go up to Health Sciences University, medical stuff.
We're not in Reese's house, so we're still... I'm going to put it some reasons.
Okay. We're in recess for 5 minutes. welcome back into session, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 447. Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and committee members. Floyd Przanski, State Senator, District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. With me today is Sybil Hebb, as well as John Van Lanningham. Senate Bill 447 is a bill that was requested by an individual from Eugene named John Brown. John and I have worked on many issues over the years, and this particular one is one that we actually looked at 2 years ago, but determined that the work that needed to be done couldn't be completed during the session. And so during the part of the interim, John Brown has been working with the two to my right as to trying to accommodate different concerns and needs. John Brown brought this bill. What this actually would do is would allow for public areas that are on waterways, specifically are almost always the public land is going to be controlled by the Department of Transportation. A lot of this is where you have a right-of-way where a bridge is on over over a river, and underneath there you have a lot of times individuals who are staying, residing in those locations, in some cases creating what's known as a transient camp area. In the vicinity of Eugene, with the two rivers that we have, both the Willamette and the McKenzie, there have been times where when the high water starts to come about because of the rains returning in the fall, a lot of these camps are just outright abandoned, and because they are abandoned with a lot of different items in those areas, they can be taken into the waterways and actually cause problems within contamination of the waterways, and can cause a lot more concern as well as need and cost for cleaning these areas up. But at the same time, knowing that you do have individuals who are limited as to where they may be staying or living, that we wanted to be assured that we were having a process in place that would, in fact, allow for notice to be given to one of these areas where individuals are camping, that they know that they need to remove their personal belongings, that the Department of Transportation will be coming in and actually clearing the area, but giving them an opportunity to, one, be aware, and two, taking care of removing their personal belongings before it's vacated and items are taken up. But one of the keys concerns that has been in the and previously and what the current statutes require is that if one of these camp areas is being cleaned up and items are being taken away, there's a requirement that any agency, specifically in this one, ODOT, would be required to actually maintain control and possession of this of these articles for a period of time, I believe for 30 days. And as you can imagine, that can be very taxing on the system as to being able to, one, bring everything into one place, maintaining and controlling it, itemizing it for over a 30-day period before they can actually get rid of it. What we do know is that in many cases, we have individuals have items there that are really probably not anything of personal worth, or and is just basically trash. And what this bill would actually allow for is a means for the ODOT to be able to come in, remove the items, and actually dispose of the items without having this wait, with some understandings as to how this would be carried out with certain other parameters. Because of those technical parts, I am not going to try to explain to this committee that. That's why I have a certified smart person to my right, and Sybil Hebb, who has been working again with John and with John Van Lanningham and John Brown to meet accommodations. So I'm going to let Ms. Hebb go next.
Senator, let me ask you a question first to be clear. This appears to be being more restrictive on ODOT than is currently allowed. Is that correct? Because I assume that they have the authority now, if someone is trespassing on state property, to go in and remove the hitting materials that's there. Is that incorrect?
I would say yes and no. Yes and no to your answer to your question, because it's not really more restrictive as much as it's more of a procedure, a policy that has to be followed
for them to actually act on removing and disposing of that property. Now they have certain obligations that are required to have a posting, and then they have a duty to maintain for a period of time all of that property in their possession. So,
okay.
For more clarification,
question. Senator Dreher.
Thank you. Senator Brzezinski, you stated that during flood, and that was one of the things that you talked about, is that sometimes these camps are abandoned. And the problem I have reading the bill is there is a five-day requirement to have it posted, and oftentimes floods are a day or two, and then all of a sudden we're in a flood stage. So don't you think that we need, if reading through this in the dash threes, don't you think we need some language in case there is a flood so that that is voided out so we don't need to post for 5 days?
Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, I would assume there's a couple of things here, and we do have someone here that's from ODOT that may be able to give more clarity. I believe they have the authority in an emergency to take whatever action they need to take under that type of scenario. What this is basically trying to do is set up the uniformity, and it's not limited to just when the let's say the waters are going to be rising because of the rains are starting. This can be acted at any time during the year. What we want to do is have uniformity as to when they have to post a minimum number of days and when they are going to come in and how long it's going to, the process will continue until they are able to complete. But I believe in my discussions previously that if there was a dire emergency that they could come in and take action without relying on this statute.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. Clarifying that this is a permissive bill. It doesn't say ODOT shall. And then secondly, I'm also clarifying that it doesn't authorize anybody other than ODOT to take these actions, like Friends of the XYZ River.
Yeah, and Senator Beyer, Senator Edwards, you're correct on both. Okay. It is permissive, and it is not one that can be, at least from my reading of the bill and the amendments, delegated to any other organization or acted upon as a self-help.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Anything else? Thank you, Senator. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center in support of Senate Bill 447 with the Dash 3 amendments, and we very much appreciate the Senator's, Senator Brzezinski's support of our bringing this bill forward in negotiation with John Brown, a great environmental activist. We have created through the bill an exception to what our current ODOT requirements to post and give 10 days notice under current statute on any ODOT-owned land before they can remove property. This bill creates a reduced notice period for camps that are along riverbanks, under bridges, in urban growth boundaries, which is where there is the greatest sort of tension between the needs of people homeless and their protection of property and river quality. And so in that circumstance, we've crafted through the bill and the proposed amendments a five-day notice period that ODOT may give, so that's much more expedited than under current statute, but in a sort of accompaniment with the reduced notice period, we've also codified some protections for people so that they may have a greater sort of a more specific notice that's posted, and it's required that it be laminated and weather resistant, so it's less likely to get destroyed by the elements, and people are more likely to have actual information in front of them about when the notice, when the property will be removed by ODOT if it's not removed first. And our basic theory here is that homeless individuals who are forced to live on the streets, under bridges, with nowhere else to go, their personal property is incredibly important to them, and they don't have anywhere else to store it. And so giving some advance notice and making sure that that's effective notice is really important in helping them to maintain their sleeping bag, for example, or their tents, things that protect them from the elements, their medications, other things that are incredibly important to them. And our theory is that given notice, they will be motivated to move that stuff, and then therefore there will be a reduced burden on the Department of Transportation to move it. The requirements of storage do continue to apply only to personal property that is of utility and not to junk or trash or other items that are left along the riverside. And they are, ODOT is allowed under the statute, which is under the proposed amendments, which also codify what their current policy and practice is, to store that property in a location, the reasonable, the useful property, that is, in a location that's reasonably accessible and secure, and to give the person the ability to try to retrieve that property. It also provides that if ODOT follows those procedures, they may charge that cost of storage against the person whose property it is. And so we think it's a fair process that effectively balances the needs of people to have access to their essential personal items, but also balances the need of ODOT to be able to remove stuff effectively and efficiently. So there's a summary of the amendments in my testimony. There are specific notice requirements, again, that codify current policies related that ODOT has in place about posting notice, but does reduce the current 10-day notice period down to a 5-day notice period and gives ODOT a 2-week window after posting the notice within which to remove property. And that was...
Why the 2-week? I mean, why isn't the 5 days sufficient?
Mr. Chair, the Robin Freeman's here from ODOT. In my discussions with her, because of how the work crews work, and depending on when the posting occurred, you could find yourself like posting like on a Friday. If there's not teams working on Saturday and Sunday, which they normally wouldn't be, then you would be limited as to the number of days that they could actually act. In the discussions, it was determined that if they had 2 weeks from the time after they post, they're going to put on the notice when they're going to come in and actually start vacating the items there, that would be ample time to make certain that they could complete the work, depending on what other obligations that those crews may have, and understanding that in some cases these camps could be inundated with massive amounts or volume of items.
So I'm trying to figure out, though. I understand the 5 days adequate notice, but what if their work pressures, they don't get around to it until the 21st day?
Kick the senator out of his good place to be. Thank you, Chair Beyer. John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid. One of the concepts here is that... let me back up a little bit. Current law already requires a 10-day notice for ODOT to do this. And current law already requires 30-day storage. So what's different in this bill? That 10-day notice can be a permanent sign. So our thinking, and it's based on experience from a lot of homeless advocacy around the state, is that people ignore permanent signs. I think all of us do. Posted signs on highways, posted no camping signs along the river. And so what we're thinking is that in a sign that's actually posted right now or tomorrow and that's dated that day is going to say to people, this is real, we know about your camp, we're going to throw your junk away if you don't remove it. Not your junk, that's a legal term that actually has some meaning. Oddly enough, it's defined in ORS already. So this notice is saying, we know about this campsite, and if you don't remove your property, we're going to come and remove it. We don't want that to be open-ended forever. We're thinking that it needs to be for a set period of time so that people feel the immediacy to get their stuff out of there. We started with 5 to 10, I think, or 5 to 7, and ODOT said that wouldn't work for them and asked for 14 days, so that's why it's that particular period. But the purpose is to say to the campers, this is an immediate issue, you've got to do something now.
Thank you. Senator Girard?
Thank you, Chair Barr. Sybil, I talked to you. Maybe, John, you want to weigh in on this. And that's the posting requirement. I did land use, and I gave Sybil this example. And the people that opposed my development would go out and steal the posting sign and then claim it hadn't been posted. Now, I think that's a lot more common than people realize, and that, don't you think that maybe in the bill we need to, what constitutes a legal posting? Because the first thing that's going to happen is that sign is going to go in the river.
Chair Beyer and Senator Gerard, I do land use too. And I wasn't aware of that particular aspect of being able to defeat a land use posting. At the state, we don't get to that level. But ODOT actually raised this concern with us earlier in our discussions, and we actually started by saying we wanted them to go out and repost. And their response is that's difficult for us to do. So what we've done actually in the bill is language that only requires reposting if they go to the campsite to do the actual removal, and the sign's gone. And then the purpose of the reposting at that point would be that the sign has the phone number on where they can call. So I think we've addressed that by not requiring reposting if the sign is torn down. If we need to make that clearer, then we would do that. But that was our agreement with ODOT. If the sign is torn down, you have to post it.
Mm-hmm.
But if the sign is torn down, there's no requirement that we expect that you have to repost it, other than when you go to the campsite to actually physically remove the stuff. If you see the signs down, then we would require you to repost just so that there's a phone number so that when the campers come back, they know where to call to get the stuff. Mm-hmm. And we think getting the stuff is probably in ODOT's interest, because if the people will get the stuff, then ODOT doesn't have to store it.
I had the same concern as Senator Gerard had, and I'm reading the language in the dash 3, and it says that the sign be posted no less than 5 days and no more than 19 days prior to the date of removal. If the notice is removed during the posting period, the department shall replace the notice prior to the removal of the property. But I don't think it's clear from this language.
So, this is Chair Beyer, Senator Burdick. I think that Sybil's written testimony makes that clearer, but I would agree with you that the text could be clearer.
Yeah, I would recommend that you do this, because the way this reads, I think somebody
could
be under the impression that, wait, they didn't replace the notice the minute it was down, therefore we don't have to remove the stuff.
Understand.
Any other questions? Anything else?
Twina.
Hi. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Liz Weber. I'm from an organization called JOIN. I'm an outreach worker with JOIN, and I'm here testifying in favor of Senate Bill 447. JOIN is a nonprofit organization that helps homeless folks move into permanent housing. And in my job as outreach worker, I encounter many people who have had the situation of losing all their stuff because either the camp wasn't posted or where to retrieve their belongings wasn't posted. The impact of the loss of property could be devastating. Sometimes it's the cold weather gear, and since we just experienced some unusual February weather, you can imagine how important a sleeping bag or a tarp might be to someone, and to come back to your camp at night and realize it's not there is a very serious matter. Sometimes the things that are missing are legal papers, court notices, medications, and very critically, people's identification. And I would like to tell a brief story just about a couple I work with who was camping on the Willamette River, for whom this became a significant issue. They were camping out of the center downtown in Portland. And they had been camping there for a few years, and it was in an area that was unclear who was in charge of it. So every once in a while, a property owner would come through and ask them to move, and they were very responsive, and they would pack up their stuff and move to the next spot until a government agency would come through and ask them to move along. And this happened several times in the couple years that I knew them, until at one point they had both left their camp for the day, which is unusual. Usually one person stayed there, and when they came back, all their stuff was gone. Their tent was gone, their sleeping bags were gone, their cook stove, their food, and they're out in North Portland, not close to services at all. So as you can imagine, this was a huge loss for them. But in addition to losing all those immediate things, unfortunately, they left their IDs there, and they had just started a housing process. So they were working with the VA and the Housing Authority of Portland, and every part of this process requires ID. The VA requires ID, the Housing Authority, any potential landlord who might rent to them. And so in best case scenario, if we're starting from square one with somebody who's lost their ID, who doesn't have a birth certificate, it's going to take at least a month. And that's if nothing goes wrong. People have to send away for their birth certificate. They have to find some sort of statement of their Social Security number. And unfortunately, in this couple's case, things were much more complicated. He was born in Illinois, and he was born at home and didn't have a record, a hospital record of his birth. So what ended up happening was an attorney was required. He needed to get in touch with an older sister who he hadn't talked to in 20 years, and it ended up taking over 6 months for him to get the ID, and it would have taken longer if we didn't have an attorney on our board who was willing to do this work pro bono. So the effect of this was they very, very nearly lost their housing. It came down to within days that there was a window of opportunity with the VA, and we were very lucky that it turned out the way it did, and they're still in housing and they're doing well. But this is the effect of what happens if campers aren't given notice, and if there's no place to retrieve their important papers and documents and possessions. So Joyne's very supportive of the need to keep our green spaces green and the efforts to remove the debris from the water. And we support this bill because it requires two essential things to the campers. The first is the advanced written notice. And it's win-win. Most campers are very invested in getting their stuff out of there, and they are responsive, and they don't want to lose it, and they don't want to go through the process of getting their ID again. And we've observed this to work very effectively in Portland, where the police are required to post 24 hours prior to cleanup. The second key element is the storage and the laminated sign that lets people know where they can find their stuff if it's been taken away. For some people, they're in the hospital when it happens, or they've gotten up enough money to spend a night or two in a motel. So it's really important to have some place for these folks to find their belongings that's reasonably accessible and available to them. So we appreciate all the hard work that's gone into the bill, and we encourage you to support it.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I just wanted to follow up on a question that was asked previously about emergency circumstances and ODOT's ability to make to respond. And the bill does provide an exception from all of the notice and storage requirements where there is an emergency that threatens the health or safety of either people or threatens contamination because of hazardous materials. And so that is written into the statute. So I just wanted to make that clear.
But to clarify, what we specifically said would be that the seasonal rains are not an emergency. So in Oregon, it rains every October. Rivers rise every October. So we would expect, or what the bill actually says, is that that's not an emergency. So when the rain rises in October, somebody should be planning for that.
Senator Durrell?
I actually have two questions. Thank you, Chair Barr. First one is, how long does ODOT have to store this material?
Senator Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, for 30 days.
The current law already, too.
Yes.
I realize, Colonel. And the second thing, going back to the flood, I read the language that you had in there, and I understand seasonal rains, but could we put something in there that there could be an opt-out during a flood alert or something? Because, a bona fide flood, you don't have 5 days. Most of the time, it's a snow, heavy, fast snow melt. There's a lot of them. So we get a snow one day and rain the next, and we have a flood. So since we're going to, I think we're kind of headed to doing a couple amendments, I just think that you would be willing to maybe
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, we actually tried to think of how to distinguish a flood from the rains that come every October and the river, when the rivers rise. And frankly, from our experience, it's the summer camping. It's the people who have been camping over the summer along the rivers. I mean, Senator Beyer knows our river pretty well, and you can't see those campsites very well except from the river. And then when the rains come in October and the rivers rise, that's when people abandon those camps, and stuff gets washed into the river. So what we're trying to say here is that you should anticipate that's going to happen. If we'll go back and do some more work. We tried to do what you were suggesting earlier, and we couldn't find a good way to say it, but we'll try again.
Okay. I think you have merit to the bill. It's just, I think it needs a little bit of tweak here and there.
Yeah. And I do want to add, in regard to the question that you and Senator Burdick raised earlier, Sybil's testimony on the second page, the third bullet, was how we intended that language to read, but it's not as clear. And I think what we need to say is somehow to say something along the lines of that there's no need to repost except on the day of removal when you show up and the sign's been torn down, and the purpose of that reposting then is so people can find their stuff.
And that
the fact that the sign's been torn down does not make the first posting invalid. So we can be more...
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Potter.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Tim Potter. I'm the Oregon Department of Transportation Legislative Coordinator. I work for the Highway Division. My normal job is the area manager for the area that encompasses Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. So I'm here today to talk about the effects of Senate Bill 447 with the Dash 3 amendments on ODOT's practices. Currently, ODOT inspects about 6,700 state, city, and county bridges. About almost 2,700 of those are on the state system. And we have determined that the Dash 3 amended version of Senate Bill 447 would impact about 335 state bridges that fit the definition of over a waterway and within an urban growth boundary. Under current law, as the previous folks testified, we do have established rules to guide the removal of personal property that doesn't fit the definition of junk. We established this policy as guidance for our staff to try and wend their way through the ORSs and OARs so that they would know how to properly handle it. We do post in frequently used places permanent signs, but where there are no permanent signs, we generally just post with a written notice that in English and Spanish that does provide a 10-day notice before we remove the material. I'd like to point out that the employees that remove the property are the same employees that would respond to traffic emergencies, weather emergencies, other sorts of things. And as part of their process to remove personal property, they also coordinate with local law enforcement and often even hazmat teams to clear up these sites. They run into biohazards and other horrific detritus when they get there. While we're sensitive to the needs of those folks that don't have a home, we do have the responsibility to maintain both the infrastructure of our system and then also the safety of our employees and those folks that have the responsibility to clean up. As the previous folks said, the bill does require us to post in English and Spanish on a laminated and weather-resistant temporary posting 5 days, but not more than 19 days prior to removal, and that notice must include the date it was posted, the date by which the property owners must remove their material, and the date we will come in to remove what's left. And then we would repost at the time of removal if that sign was previously removed. You'd asked earlier about the 14 days. That was an area that we discussed with the bill proponents. We've got some examples of sometimes it just takes that long. We had an example right out here in Salem while I was the area manager in 2007. The managers of the local Costco had asked us to look into the campsite that was right there on the other side of Mill Creek from them at the intersection of Oregon 22 and I-5 in that large kind of wooded area there. We went in. They notified us on February 28th, and we started at that point. We already had a permanent sign there, but we, acknowledging that the 10 days prior, we went down and made sure that, yes, there was indeed in a camp, and we're going to wait 10 days before we went there. On the 14th, we actually went and posted a temporary notice and said, we're going to be down here and take stuff in 2 days. Over the next 2 days, we arranged brush cutting equipment. We arranged with the Salem police to join us to make sure that people moved out expeditiously, and it was a safe thing. As we started the cleanup, which was now on March 16th, so we're now a little over 2 weeks after the start of the initial location, we started the cleanup, found a terrible biohazard situation. We ended up calling Northwest Firefighters, and they got their hazmat teams. We arranged a contract with them. That was a 3-day process, 1 day to arrange the for them to come do the work and 2 days for them to do the removal. And then we started the cleanup again after they were completed. We were not fully completed with the cleanup of that site until March 24th, so that basically 11 days after we initially posted that we're going to be here in 2 days, folks. So it nearly is a 2-week process when we have everything going on. So I just wanted to make sure that you understood that's kind of the minimum amount of time, some in a very hazardous spot that we can work with. I think to summarize, we have negotiated with the bill proponents and discussed with them what specific requirements they felt they needed to have, and that we can work within those guidelines. Are there any questions for me?
Senator Durant?
Thank you, Chairman. To me, the bill actually is a little bit more restrictive than current law. Is that kind of the way? I mean, you went from 10 days to 5 days. Where is it more restrictive? Because the posting, you said you posted before, so I'm trying to figure out where it's more restrictive, if there is a spot in there. Do you feel like this is a more restrictive bill for ODOT?
Again, we've worked with the proponents, and we understand their concerns about folks being given appropriate notice to remove their material, and we want to be sensitive to the issues of those folks. So our primary concerns were having the narrow window that they'd originally proposed between the posting and when we had to have done the cleanup, and we worked through that 2-week period to provide us the time we needed to do.
Second question. Health professional, I mean, when you clean up these areas, are people suggested that they put masks and gloves on, or how does that work?
Chair Byer, Senator Girard, we our folks actually do go in with gloves and their appropriate safety equipment, and if it looks like there may be drug waste or other things that would create a personal hazard to them, they back out and then contact appropriate professionals to do that removal.
Mm-hmm. More?
Go ahead.
Sorry, Richard.
The bill refers to under a state highway bridge. I believe in the Costco case, it was actually in the woods near a bridge.
That's correct. That was prior to this bill specifically. Again, prior to this instrument being introduced, we dealt with, I think the Oregon statute is ORS 377.650, which just covers illegal campsites on Oregon right-of-way. This now narrows it to a specific spot. But again, we will be faced with trying to figure out what sites are under this type restriction as opposed to the other types, and we probably will rewrite our procedure to generalize to whichever is the more restrictive, so that we have a consistent process throughout the state. One of the things we struggle with is trying to give guidance to our maintenance folks so that they behave appropriately in all instances, and we don't necessarily want them interpreting whether this spot falls under this type of rule and this spot falls under a different type of rule. We would try and make it general.
Is there a reason we wouldn't want to use the existing statute that you just referenced and make this condition, if we want with this, apply just to that? Is that clear?
I think you'd have to speak to the bill proponents around that. I mean, we...
Because I'm thinking about that. Come on up, John. It's not just under the bridges that I think the people are concerned with. I mean, the site you referenced, there are a lot of those like that.
That's correct.
So, Chair Byer, this bill is very narrow. It's just ODOT-owned or state-owned land underneath bridges that ODOT owns within UGBs alongside rivers. And that was the issue that John Brown brought to the special session in 2010. That was our negotiation with him. And as lobbyists, we probably made an error and wrote a very narrow relating clause. And so this bill itself can't cover all of their areas.
I see. Relating clause.
We actually thought about trying to find another bill to do that, because ODOT had said to us they would like to be consistent across all their areas. We'd be glad to work with them to make that happen, but this bill can't do that.
You could adjust your policies.
And again, that, Chair Byer, that's most likely what we'll do, just as a matter of expeditious process. We try and make sure that we follow both rules with one policy.
Okay. Anything else? Any other questions? No. Well, we have no fiscal on this, on the amendment at least.
Just for the record, we did get written testimony from John Brown in support of the bill. That was handed out.
There were a couple issues brought up. I assume that the ODOT and the proponents will get together and see if they can reach an amendment. And then when you have that done, we'll consider the bill again. Work with the committee administrator on getting that done. Appreciate it. Anything else on this? We'll close on Senate Bill 447. And is there anything else to come before the committee?
I would say
there is none. We are adjourned.